Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motyka, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, health in the news, and a variety of topics. And before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation.
Dr. Lawrence Rosenblum is professor of psychology at the University of California, Riverside. He is an award-winning teacher of perceptual, cognitive, and introductory psychology. Professor Rosenblum has published more than 40 journal articles and book chapters on audiovisual speech perception, face perception, and general auditory perception. Upon receiving his PhD from the University of Connecticut, Professor Rosenblum established his own laboratory at the University of California, Riverside, where he studies auditory speech and multisensory perception. His work has helped reveal a number of exotic perceptual skills, including our ability to echolocate like bats, to recognize rooms by how they reflect sound, and to hear the location, size, and even shape of objects by how they block sounds. His lab has also helped determine that we all lip-read, and that we can't help but integrate lip-read and heard speech, a skill we begin to learn as infants. He has shown that we can recognize people based solely on seeing how their faces move, and that we can match faces to voices with surprising accuracy. His most recent research shows us that as we converse with someone, we unwittingly imitate aspects of how they speak, whether we hear or lip-read what they're saying. Dr. Rosenblum, thank you very much for agreeing to be on the program today.
My pleasure.
Professor Rosenblum, the main thesis of your new book, See What I'm Saying, The Extraordinary Power of the Five Senses, is that recent research clearly overturns our traditional view of the five senses as being located in different parts of the brain. So first, can you please describe the old way of looking at perception, and then how your research, as well as that of others, suggests a new model for how we perceive and blend sensory input?
Yes, I think the old model is that different parts of the brain process the senses separately. So there would be a visual part of the brain, the visual cortex, that would deal only with visual input, and an auditory cortex that deals only with auditory input. But I think that's changed over the last 10 to 15 years. I think there's now very compelling evidence that the visual cortex actually detects information that might come through the auditory system and vice versa, that the auditory cortex detects information that comes through the visual system. And that's probably the story all across the senses. I think that a lot of this research has come from new imaging technologies and is very consistent with what we've been seeing in the perception lab with having people judge very simple stimuli and showing that cross-sensory influences occur in almost every context that's ever been studied.
It's a very interesting field of research endeavor, and I think there must be an interesting backstory to how you became interested in this.
Yeah, my own interest in perceptual psychology came from when I was a young kid. Both of my parents were social workers, and they worked with sensory-deprived populations. My dad worked with the blind, and my mom worked with the deaf. And I remember visiting their offices and really being overwhelmed by how well many of these people were able to compensate for their deficits. And I was also really intrigued by the sorts of devices that were designed to help these folks out. And interestingly enough, I think very recent research on cross-sensory compensation bears out a lot of what I saw as a child, that in fact, when the visual cortex no longer gets visual input, it gets used by the auditory and touch systems to a large degree. So this is starting to make sense to us neurophysiologically as well as practically functionally.
We'll come back to that in a moment, but I wanted to ask you to first tell us about something I would have thought prior to reading your book was absolutely impossible, and that is the blind baseball teams and how that game works.
Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating. I had a chance to watch a series of games and interview a number of the players, and the way this works is they have a softball-sized ball that beeps, and they're able to bat and field and throw based on the sound of the ball, as well as the sound that the bases make. It's somewhat different rules, pretty much everybody on the field is blind, and if not completely blind, they're blindfolded anyway. The only person that's not blind is the pitcher, and actually the catcher is not blind as well, and they are on the same team as the batter. So the pitcher will try to throw the ball so the batter hits the ball, and then it's the blind fielder's job to stop the ball and get possession of the ball before the batter runs towards one of two bases that are also making sound. It's just an amazing thing to watch, and it's very exciting and a lot of fun.
So they don't know what base they're going to have to run towards until after the ball is struck?
That's exactly correct. So they hit the ball, and then one of two bases, which are roughly in first and third base position in regular baseball, one of those will beep, and they have to run and try to tag that base before one of the fielders has possession of the ball. And if they do tag it, they get a run, and if the fielder gets possession first, it's an out. Beyond that, many of the same rules apply to beat baseball as from regular baseball.
Did you try playing blind baseball yourself?
No, I didn't. Although I have to say, we have a beeping Nerf ball in my lab. We decided to start off with a Nerf ball rather than a softball because we thought it would be a little less dangerous. And we have kind of trained ourselves to catch it fairly well. It takes a lot of practice. And that's something I should mention about these beep baseball athletes. They are very serious about the game. They have a World Series, and they do a lot of training, and the batter and pitcher practices for hours and hours before the season actually starts. So it does take a lot of practice, but they're able to use the sound of the approaching ball as well as the sound of the base as they approach it to play quite an exciting and engaging game.
From there, I want to ask you about the echolocation. The fellow, I've forgotten his name, who does mountain biking and actually takes other blind people mountain biking using the sounds generated by their bicycles.
Yeah, this is just an amazing story. I did go biking with them. The folks that lead this group are Brian Bushway and Daniel Kish. Daniel is blind from birth. Brian was blind, I guess, as an adult. And they are able to mountain bike and teach people to mountain bike by using echolocation. Echolocation is basically the same type of things bats do, where they make sounds for Daniel and Brian. They make clicking sounds with their tongue, like that type of sound. And those sounds leave their mouth and then reflect off of the major obstacles that are on the trail, whether boulders or like tree trunks, you know, the edge of the trail they can hear where the grass changes to dirt. And they're able to do this well enough to mountain bike and hike and actually have had some success teaching other blind individuals to do so.
And what was it like?
Oh, it's just amazing. I mean, after a while, it's very much just like mountain biking with friends. Brian, in particular, has had a lot of experience on the trails that we were on, and he was much faster and more coordinated than I was on the trail. The only real difference is that you hear clicks. You hear they click probably once every few seconds to get a sense of where things are. And beyond that, it really isn't very different at all. I should say that it's easier for them actually to do this biking on the trails where there really aren't too many terribly dangerous hazards. What they really are much more concerned about is biking on the roads, on the side roads. So we had to leave Brian's driveway to get to the trail and had to ride on the streets for about 10, 15 minutes. And they can certainly hear the cars as they're coming down the road, but they have to be very careful of obstacles such as parked cars and other like garbage cans, other obstacles there on the street. And there they click much more often to get a much more precise sound of where things are. But they're able to do it, and they do it frequently. And as I said, they have had some success teaching newly blind people to do this. It takes a lot of concentration, but the information is there for their auditory systems to use.
One of the things that you also mention is that we actually echolocate all the time.
Yeah.
And that your experiments in that have shown that we actually possess a marked ability to do so. Can you give us some concrete examples of things in your research that would surprise us about the naive sighted person's ability to echolocate?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, our own research has conducted a number of different experiments testing the ability of sighted people to echolocate. And what we generally find is that when a sighted introductory psychology student comes into our lab, and we tell them a little bit about what echolocation is and tell them that they're going to be doing it, they first have absolutely no belief that they'll be able to do it at all. But then we blindfold them and tell them a little more about the technique. And every one of our subjects we've ever tested, after being blindfolded and trying it out for 10, maybe 15 minutes, have all been able to do it. They all are able to walk towards a wall and stop right before they get there. This is something anybody can try at home. In our experiments, of course, we control the distance of the wall so subjects can't use footstep counting or something like that. But all of our subjects are amazed, but then completely convinced that this is something they can do. And there's research showing that sighted folks that have been blindfolded just for a little while are able to even determine things like the shape of an obstacle that's in front of them, the texture on the obstacle, whether it's covered with carpeting or some maybe plastic or wood or something like that. They can make those sort of discriminations. And I think the truth is that even though we don't actively echolocate, which is what our subjects do in our experiments, as well as what Dan Kish and Brian do on the bike trail, we probably passively echolocate all the time. And what that means is that we use the sounds that are reflected inside of a room to determine something about the size and shape and things that occupy the room. So yes, when we walk into a new room, we get a sense of these things by looking. But we also get a sense from listening, even if we're not aware of doing so. And these sounds are not necessarily emitted from our own bodies. These can be sounds from the ventilation or other sounds in the room that are kind of constructing this ambient reflected space that our auditory systems seem sensitive to.
In your book, you mention that people can tell whether a rod held in front of them is sideways or upright. Does that require any training? And also, do they need to make a noise, or are they picking that up off of the ambient?
For real, I guess, very, very precise sort of judgments, there's no question that it helps to generate your own sound. And it also helps to have a little feedback, to find out how you're doing. But in the sort of experiments we do in our lab, we don't like to give too much feedback, because we're really interested in them kind of having a perceptual experience of something in front of them, rather than kind of concentrating on maybe some of the more sensory aspects of this sounds a little darker than this. We really are interested in having them have the experience of an object in front of them. Now, certainly, as I said, making your own sound helps, but in other experiments, we've shown that people can determine the shape of an object that's occluding sound sources, like a series of loudspeakers or something like that. There really doesn't need to be a whole bunch of sound there for us to have that skill. Now, I know this does sound strange if you don't know the research on this, but the folks that certainly know this and are absolutely convinced of this are sound engineers that work on movies and television. They are very, very careful about how they kind of change the sounds of recorded voices for movies and TV shows, because they believe that the auditory system is very sensitive to these sort of reflected sound structures. So they put a lot of money and effort into making these things sound as natural as possible. So when I interviewed these folks, they were absolutely not surprised about this research. Scientists are much more surprised than these folks in the industry.
It certainly makes sense. There's a lot of money involved in the movie industry. And you were actually able to interview a very unique person, the person who created the first believable computer-generated face. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience? That must have been fascinating.
Sure. Yeah, it was a really interesting experience for me as a writer, because I actually wrote that section of the book before this occurred. So this is a story called The Uncanny Valley, and probably a lot of your listeners have experienced this sort of thing, where they've seen a computer animated face, whether it's something to depict a character in a movie or in a computer game, where if it seems almost real, there seems to be something zombie-like about it. Some of the classic examples are a movie called The Polar Express that had Tom Hanks' voice, and they animated a number of characters based on Tom Hanks' face that were to look like Tom Hanks. And a lot of people found the characters in that film very, very eerie. It's a very well-known effect. There's been a number of other movies where they've tried to animate what would look like a convincing human face. And this uncanny valley phenomenon has to do with the fact that the closer you approximate the realism in a human face, it works up to a point, but then when it gets almost real but not quite real, we get very sensitive to any deviation in the reality of it, and the face seems dead. It seems zombie-like. Now, there's been research on this, on how this occurs. And I was writing up this chapter. The film Benjamin Button came out. They have this amazingly rendered character, the Benjamin Button character, who seems basically like Brad Pitt aging backwards. And people didn't realize that the first half of the movie, Brad Pitt is never actually seen. It is all computer generated. And as soon as I heard about the film and then they won the Academy Award for special effects, I ran out and interviewed them on how they did it. I interviewed one of the main animators on what sort of techniques they used. And basically, they used some very, very impressive modern technologies. But really what it came down to is kind of compulsive attention to detail in a human face. And just to give you an example of this, this just absolutely floored me. When we shift our eyes, when human eyes shift to the left and right, there's a collection of moisture that's somewhat greater to whatever side the eye is moving towards. So when we shift our eyes to the left, there's a little bit more moisture that collects on the eye on the left side than the right side. They found that if they didn't do that with Benjamin Button, that he wouldn't seem real. The human brain is so sensitive to those subtle details that if they didn't do that exactly right, that the uncanny valley phenomenon would happen and people would find the character eerie. And that was the case all the way through.
The analogy is if you have a glass of water in your hand and you move it, the water sort of splashes to one side. And when we move our eyeballs, the water in our eyeballs builds up.
Absolutely. I guess what everyone was so amazed by was the fact that these very subtle differences are perceivable by the audience. And that made a huge difference in how convincing the face was.
But that brings us back to one of the other important threads in your book, which is the subliminal, or at least below the level of consciousness, fine-tuning of perception. And it informs this other thread that I perceived in your book, which I guess I'm going to call functional chunking for survival. It's almost as if a lot of these pre-processing things are being done at such a fundamental level that you almost are processing the information and filtering what comes in through the senses based on the processing. And almost all of these, the things about mating, the things, for example, about identifying zombies versus human, very strong survival value.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think you're saying that it's absolutely necessary that these things be under the level of consciousness. I think that what the research has shown recently is that it's not just that some of these things sneak in, it's as if we have entire channels of informational input that sneak in, such as reflected sound, such as undetectable smells, that sort of thing, that have some influence. And in some cases, it's subtle. In some cases, it's probably pretty profound. They have influences over behavior and our kind of aesthetic experience. And the other thing that's, I think, really interesting is that some folks have learned to, either from, you know, personal reasons, some sort of sensory loss, or professional reasons, to actually kind of enhance these skills and make them more conscious and make them more volitional. And so it's as if this kind of subliminal process that goes on just under the level of consciousness is accessible in some ways. We wouldn't want it accessible all the time because, as you said, it would just detract from, you know, what's really necessary in our survival. But it can be accessible with training and practice.
Well, it seems to me that the real revolution that we've had in terms of our technology and its ability to visualize active processing in the brain is one of the reasons that you've been able to do a lot of your research. And I particularly wanted to talk about the wine tasting and the training for a wine sommelier, I believe it's pronounced.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
What you can tell us about how the brain processing changes and also how it doesn't change compared to a naive taster. I was quite surprised by what you had to say.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are really surprised by this. The research suggests that despite our intuitions, these expert wine tasters, these master sommeliers, really don't have any more of a sensitive palate as such. It's not as if they've trained their tongues or their mouths, even their nose, to at a sensory level to really detect things differently. What they've been able to do is basically build up a conceptual expertise. They learn very explicit information, very kind of book-based information about how wines are produced and how wines are grown. And then they learn from that to kind of attend to things that we're actually all able to sense, like to attend to certain constellations of flavors. And so rather than, you know, using some sort of sensory aspects of their brains differently, they're really using more almost the rational and certainly the linguistic aspects of their brains. They're able to categorize the information differently. Again, it's really based on kind of this explicit knowledge of what's going on. So I interviewed, for the book, I interviewed a master sommelier who has to go through this test where he's given, I believe, 6 wines. And he has to sip them and has then, I think, 15, 20 minutes to determine what wine it is, where it was grown, the year that it was bottled, the region, the grape, all that sort of thing, and justify why he's making those decisions. And he has to get all of them pretty much right in order to pass and be given the title Master Sommelier. And these folks spend, you know, years and years attaining this ability. And it really is, yes, it's from tasting, but it's from a kind of an intellectually guided tasting that really changes the way the entire brain kind of approaches flavor, not the senses as such. It really is much more of a cognitive sort of approach to enhancing one's perceptual experience.
The tongue is actually a great topic. Let's spend some time on some of the research you describe about how we taste. I'm particularly responding to my training. I was an undergraduate in psychology, and that little map that we had on in our textbook of where sweet was located and where salty was located. But tell us about the Q-tip experience and how touch influences taste. I found that fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be quite honest with you. I hadn't done research on taste myself and didn't know a lot about the literature. And then when I went into it to pull out the most interesting things for the book, I was absolutely amazed at what goes on. I think from the point of view of somebody who does multisensory perception, taste actually is one of the most exciting senses, because I believe it's probably the sense that is most influenced by the other senses. And the example that you just gave with Q-tips is a terrific example of how touch influences our experience of taste. So yes, you're absolutely right. Our notions of the taste map on the tongue show that we have, you know, sweet in one part of our tongue and salty in another part and all that sort of thing. But we don't experience flavor like that, right? We experience flavor as belonging to the food. So the kind of most intuitive example is to have a sweet hard candy in our mouth, and as it kind of floats around our mouth, we attribute its sweetness, the sweetness we're experiencing, to the hard candy itself. But in fact, there's a lot of times where the candy doesn't rest on a sweet taste bud. It's, you know, very far from a sweet taste bud, maybe, you know, where there's a salty taste bud or no taste buds at all. But what happens is our experience of touch on the tongue guides our experience of flavor and where flavor is coming from. I mean, we're able to perceive flavor as coming from food rather than our tongues because of the way touch kind of draws flavor to where our tongues are being touched. So you can dip a Q-tip in a sweet solution and start it on one side of the tongue where you have some sweet taste buds and draw it all the way around the outer edge of the tongue, and it will taste sweet all the way around, even though we don't have sweet taste buds through a majority of that space. But the sweetness is being pulled by where our tongues are being touched, physically touched by the Q-tip. And it's just completely compelling. I think, you know, taste is really, our sense of flavor is really based on illusory experience in this way. And I think it's also the true of the influences of smell on flavor and sight and even sound on flavor.
Yeah, talk about the potato chip experiment. I thought that was a great one.
Yeah, this is terrific. This is one of these great experiments that sounds absolutely absurd when you hear about it, but then this makes a lot of sense and turns out to be pretty important scientifically. And it is, in fact, one of these experiments that won the Ig Nobel Prize, which is exactly what that prize is given for. The intuition was that sound plays a role in how fresh a food seems to us, how fresh a food tastes to us, in fact. And so what these researchers did is they had people crunch on what they thought were different types of potato chips. So these subjects were blindfolded, they wore headphones, and then they were given potato chips, which the subjects were led to believe were different brands. As they crunched the potato chip, there was a microphone that picked up that sound, played it through a computer, and then went back into the headphones in real time. But the computer was able to modulate the sound just enough so it either sounded a little brighter, the crunching sound, or a little darker, a little bit maybe more muddled. And subjects were asked to rate how fresh, how tasty the potato chip was. Well, as it turns out, all subjects always got the same potato chip. It was a Pringle, and Pringles are pretty consistent. So that was a good choice for that control. But their experience was of different types of potato chips, even though they were getting the same chip over and over again. And importantly, the freshness of that potato chip depended on the sound they were hearing. If they were hearing a very bright sound as they were chewing, the potato chips seemed very fresh to them. If they heard a duller, kind of more muddled sound, they felt it was a staler and less flavorful chip, which is absolutely amazing. I think we all have a sense that our experience of flavor is influenced by what happens in our tongue and what happens in our nose, and maybe to some degree what happens with our vision. But flavor can also be changed by how something sounds as we're crunching it in our mouths.
Another thing about cross-sensory modality that I didn't know was that subliminals multiply. So you give the example of a imperceptible flavor and an imperceptible smell, and also how imperceptible smells affect behavior. Please amplify on those a little bit.
Sure. Yeah. The one with flavor and smell is absolutely fascinating, where each of these things on their own, say a strawberry smell and a sweet flavor, when they're presented on their own, they won't be detectable. There's lots of experimental ways you can establish that. But when put together, it becomes quite detectable. And there's ways of, in fact, adding a subliminal chocolate smell to a sweet gum, a subtly sweet gum, so that when they are experienced together, the gum tastes like chocolate. So yes, there is this what we call super additive effect for smell and for taste. And that's certainly something that occurs all over the sensory systems. But I think it turns out to be very compelling for most people when it comes to something like flavor. Now, smell, I think, is just some of the research that's been done on smell over the last 10 years has just been absolutely fascinating. I think now there's very compelling evidence that smell affects us in what we would historically call a subliminal way. So without being able to have a conscious experience of a smell, that smell can still affect us. And affect us in often subtle ways, but affect us in replicable and statistically significant ways. So one of the most compelling examples of this is an experiment where subjects came into a laboratory and were asked to do a number of different tasks, many of them having to do with cleaning sorts of ideas, cleaning concepts, and even some cleaning behavior. So subjects were told to look at a computer screen and say words they saw as quickly as possible. And all these different examples, there would be in the experimental condition, there would be a subliminal cleaning smell in the room. And subjects would never notice this cleaning smell. The cleaning smell might be something like a lemon cleanser or something like that, maybe a lemon dishwashing scent or something. Subjects would never notice it, and afterwards, even being told that it was in there, they would never have a recollection of it. It was presented at a very, very low level. But subjects who got that scent would be able to respond faster to reading cleaning-related words, and in a follow-up experiment, even show more cleaning-related behaviors. This is an absolutely charming manipulation. They had subjects eat a cracker, and then they videotaped the subjects as they were eating the cracker to see what sort of cleaning behaviors they would do and how many cleaning behaviors. So did they kind of brush their crumbs from the table onto their napkin? And the subject group that got this subliminal cleaning scent showed more of those sort of tidying up behaviors than the group that didn't get that scent. And again, these are all subliminally presented scent stimuli. Subjects never have any conscious awareness that the scent is there, but it does seem to have very subtle influences on behavior.
Sometimes not so subtle. You talk about soft drinks and how when you mix up the colors and the flavors, people can't detect the flavor of the soft drink correctly.
Yeah, this is a terrific example of how sight can influence our experience of flavor. This is generally shown with soft drinks. So I think people might have had the experience of tasting something that had a very light, maybe flavor of cherry or something in a, you know, like a Kool-Aid sort of drink. But the color plays a very strong role in that. So you can do a very straightforward experiments where you change the color of a soft drink and don't change the flavor, but people will say that the flavor has changed. In an experience I had, which was in a restaurant that was dark, that had no lighting. And this has actually become somewhat of a fad around the world. There's a number of restaurants like this in Europe, and now there's some in the United States where you eat your food, you have your entire meal in the dark. My experience, as was the experience of my friends, the folks that were with me, was that the food tasted a little bit more bland. Well, if you go back to the research and look at the research on this, food that lacks color or has diluted color has been shown to be experienced as having a more bland flavor than foods that have more vibrant colors. And this is something that I think chefs know to a large degree, that color plays a strong role in how much we enjoy a meal. But I think that reading the research, I was very surprised at how strong these effects could actually be.
Another strong thread I find reading your book, and actually I find it quite reassuring, is the concept of the neurologic plasticity. And this has been a very, very hot topic in medicine for the last few years as we're getting into stem cells and starting to understand exactly how we can retrain people. Just recently, I spoke to my audience about teaching people who had lost their speech output centers in a stroke that they could learn to speak if they sang what they were trying to say rather than speaking it, because it used different parts of the brain. Now, these changes occur surprisingly quickly, and we have lots of examples that are studyable of people who have lost their sight. And I know that's been one area you've done a lot of research. So tell us a little bit about what we know about the rewiring, how quickly it starts, and basically the experimental basis for that knowledge.
Sure. Yes. This is an absolutely fascinating topic. This is what we call cross-sensory compensation or cross-sensory neuroplasticity. And what this has to do with is what happens when a sense is deprived, either from, you know, some sort of blindness or deafness, or even temporarily in the lab. And I'll talk about that in just a second. But I think now there's pretty compelling evidence that for either individuals who are blind at an early age or at a later age, that the visual cortex kind of reassigns itself to the other senses to some degree. So when somebody goes blind, they're able to touch things and discriminate certain complex patterns better than the rest of us. And this happens regardless of the touch sensory training. So this is true. You might think that this has to do with learning Braille. Even though Braille might fine-tune this to some degree, it happens even for individuals who don't learn Braille. Also, there's some evidence that certain auditory skills in blind individuals are enhanced as well. And we know now from a number of different brain imaging and other sorts of neurophysiological techniques that it is the visual brain that's enhancing the other senses when this occurs. Now, I think one of the most interesting sets of findings to come out, start to see these changes, these enhancements in touch and auditory sensitivity happen that quickly, within 90 minutes of an experimental session. And we know, again, from these imaging techniques that it is the visual cortex that is basically helping out and making these other sorts of sensory channels more efficient and effective.
There were some people who were blindfolded for a longer period of time. I believe the figure was 5 days.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In that research, they had some persistent changes, didn't they, in their brain that lasted for some time?
Well, it's not terribly persistent. I'm glad you mentioned that. So these are folks that are, again, hearing and seeing individuals, young individuals, that basically check themselves into the hospital and then are blindfolded and have no light input for 5 days. And in many of these experiments, touch enhancement is tested. And what you see is a major enhancement in touch, and you see the visual cortex being involved in that enhancement. And again, that happens even without any sort of touch practice whatsoever, regardless of whether you have training in Braille. Your visual cortex helps you with touch even without having any vast experience in touch. And after the blindfold is taken off, they do have some persistence in that. It lasts about, I think, 24 hours, maybe to 48 hours, but not much more than that. So it's not persistent much beyond that, but it's impressive that it happens at all, I think. And the fact that it can happen for 5 days or 90 minutes is just really incredible.
It's very impressive. Which brings us to something else I found impressive, although it is a device that is used, and that's the tongue display unit. Mm-hmm. So tell us about the tongue display unit and how that's helping people see, but also how it works.
Yes, this is actually display units. Touch display units have been tested for quite some time, I think 40 years almost. But just recently, they've come up with a very efficient way of setting this up. A touch display unit in general is a device that hypothetically could be used by the blind to be able to experience through touch a visual scene. So it's very literal in some ways. You would point a camera to, say, a shape, a triangle, and the pattern of a triangle then would be presented through some sort of touch device on the skin, or in this very new case, on the tongue. Now, the reason why it's been on the tongue is because it actually is a very effective way to present stimuli. There's a terrific, because of the fluid there, it makes a very good contact with an electrical stimulation, and it's also relatively non-invasive. There's much more invasive ways that it had been done in the past, and it's also very portable. So what would happen with the most recent unit, the tongue display unit, is you'd have an individual point a camera to some scene, and that scene would get translated through computer processing onto a little, basically it's a postage stamp size square that's put on the tongue that has little, I guess, little pieces of metal on it. What it feels like for the person using it is as if there's, I guess, champagne bubbles kind of popping on the tongue, but they're popping in a way that's making a shape, like a triangle or a square or a disc or something like that. And with some practice, you find that individuals can actually distinguish shapes pretty well and can distinguish letters and numbers, and then can actually move around a small obstacle course, actually walk through hallways to some degree. Now, it's unclear how successful this is going to be. The resolution of these devices still isn't great. I believe they're now actually selling a for-market version of this for, I think, $10,000 or something. But it does take some training. And again, the resolution isn't terrific. But I think if nothing else, it really suggests that our touch systems are much more sensitive and more sophisticated than we thought. We don't usually think of our tongues being able to distinguish something as, I guess, complex as a like an obstacle course that we need to traverse. But it can do so. It can do so. So it's just a great example of the kind of superpowers of our touch system. It's still unclear how effective this will actually be for a device for the blind.
Do we know if the occipital cortex is lighting up as people navigate using this display unit?
Yes, I believe it is. I'm almost positive that is the case, that the visual cortex is used for these sorts of things. You find that the visual cortex, with regard to touch, the visual cortex gets involved when it comes to complex pattern touching. So it doesn't help with kind of the low level touch sensitivity. It's not like we can feel a tickle better on our skin as we use our visual cortex, but we can discern more complex patterns, whether they're braille-like patterns or the patterns that would be imparted using this tongue display unit.
Right. Of course, we're talking about the reprogramming of the brain and the use of unused neurons, essentially taking over empty real estate and putting it to good use. But sometimes this doesn't always have such a happy outcome. And I'm thinking in particular of what has up till now been a very mysterious phenomenon, phantom limb pain. I was taught that phantom limb pain was due mainly to damage to the neurons in the amputated limb. But in fact, it may be largely due to a sort of malignant reprogramming. When this reprogramming goes bad, it can go bad in several ways. Are there examples that you can explain to us how this phantom limb pain may occur and what features make it most likely?
Yes. I think a lot of the recent neuroplasticity research is showing that it's kind of the rampant neuroplasticity that causes phantom sensation and phantom limb pain. At least that's part of what's involved. What's clear is that the degree to which somebody has phantom sensation or phantom pain is closely correlated with the amount of neuroplasticity that's occurring after the amputated limb. So, for example, the somatosensory cortex gets reorganized after an amputation, and the degree to which that happens, the amount that that happens, correlates closely with phantom sensation and phantom pain. And what you find sometimes is, depending on where the amputation is and how the cortex gets reorganized, that if there is a part of the cortex that's assigned to a new body part that is distal, that's far away from the where the amputation was, that's the most likely scenario in which to have severe phantom pain. So if a hand gets amputated and then the face, for example, the skin on the face takes over the somatosensory cortex that was once given to the hand, because those parts of the body are more distal, you're likely to have more phantom pain in that case. So I believe, as much as I understand the newest research on this, they can predict fairly well how much phantom pain somebody's going to have by tracking what's going on as the cortex is reorganizing.
For the audience, I'd like to explain that on the surface of your brain, in a place that we can actually now measure with these sophisticated imaging studies, there is a sort of map of the human body called the sensory homunculus. And it's roughly proportional to the number of nerve endings that you have in a particular area. And the homunculus isn't really a little man in the same shape and size of a little man. The physical features of the body are sometimes displaced, and in this case, the hand is just right next to the face on the sensory homunculus. Is that why the sensory territory of the face, well, it sort of takes over the part where there's no input coming to the hand, so it's like, ooh, new territory, I'm going to grab it. But that somehow leads to an increased sense of perception of pain in the missing limb. Is that going to be helped, perhaps, by some sort of therapy, touching the face or touching the opposite hand?
Yeah, that is one idea. Now, it's unclear how well that kind of remapping therapy works, but it's being tried a lot. So the idea would be, one idea that's being tested a lot is to use what's called mirror therapy or mirror box therapy, where you actually get the visual brain to reorganize this sensory homunculus by basically being fooled into thinking that the actual amputated limb is still there. Now, certainly the patient knows that that's not the case, but it's as if the visual brain can be fooled into reorganizing, or I guess back organizing, the map to where the limb, the missing limb once was. And supposedly they're having some success with this. I should also mention something that's real interesting is that this issue of cross-modal plasticity and its potential negative effects has been also something that's been seen with cochlear implant patients, where the auditory cortex gets reassigned in different ways, and the degree to which it's reassigned is a good predictor of how well somebody will respond to a cochlear implant if they have that implant later in life. So this notion that a cochlear implant, which of course is this device to basically electronically stimulate the cochlea for deaf individuals, the idea that that should be done as early as possible if it's for a child is probably makes a lot of sense based on what we know about neuroplasticity, because if something else gets reassigned to that auditory cortex, it makes it much harder for the auditory cortex to go back and make use of that cochlear input.
It's as if someone moved in and built a house on a vacant lot.
Yeah, it's a nice metaphor, yeah.
So given that this sort of neural reprogramming is occurring all the time, I'd expect that learning to ride a bicycle or learning to play a musical instrument would be an area fruitful for research, maybe the instrument more than the bicycle, just for practical considerations. Have you done work in that area, and what can you tell us about that kind of reprogramming?
Yeah, I think there's been some really interesting research conducted on the shift from short-term to long-term plasticity with regard to both motor behavior and the senses. I think one of the most straightforward examples of this is an experiment where individuals who had no experience playing piano or any type of keyboard whatsoever were taught a very simple pattern on a piano keyboard, and they practiced, I believe, for 2 hours a day for a week, and brain imaging was conducted before and after each practice session. And what they found was that when people came in and before they started practicing for each session, there really wasn't much of a change in the organization of the motor map, the motor homunculus, and the motor cortex. But 2 hours of practice would change that so that the map was then devoted more to the fingers that were involved in the pattern. And that went on for a week. And so what you would find is that there'd be a short-term change that would occur after the practice that would then revert by the next day before the practice session. But then after a week, some of those subjects, I believe half those subjects, then continued to do the exact same exercise for 1 month more. And what you found for those subjects is that that reorganization would be maintained. So they would come back in the mornings before their practice session, and that reorganization would be observable even before that specific practice session. So what you would see is a shift from short-term plasticity to long-term plasticity, in this case with motor behavior. But similar things have been done, I believe, with sensory skills as well. So yes, I think that's an absolutely fascinating thing. And I think it's something that's almost intuitive for a lot of us. When we learn a new skill, we know that we need to really practice it before we can perform that skill well without first a major warm-up. When you first are learning a skill, you need some good long time to warm up to perform it well. But then after it becomes your skill, you know, becomes something that becomes second nature to you, you don't need that sort of warm-up, right? Myself, I'm learning sleight of hand magic now just to kind of prove this to myself. And I'm finding exactly that. After months of practice, I can do these kind of sleight of hand tricks without warming up. And I think, you know, for those of us who've played a musical instrument or have taken a sport seriously, that's a very intuitive experience. And it seems to be something that's right along what we know about what's going on in the plasticity of the brain.
Sometimes we have senses that we don't really give enough credit to how important they are in getting around during the day. I was struck by that when you started talking about proprioception, that is to say that the tendons and the muscles and their stretch receptors and how much that tells us about our environment and some of the remarkable things that we're able to do that probably most of my audience doesn't realize they're doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that we have some intuitions about this. So when we use a tool to, say, stir soup so we can determine whether it's thick enough to serve, or, you know, brush our hair so, you know, we have just the right amount of pressure, we have a sense that we're using our kind of complex sense of touch that includes just more than the skin, that we're actually using something deeper than that. But the research is just revealing that we can do amazing things using that kind of tendon muscle sense, as it's sometimes called. So being blindfolded and grasping just the end of an object, like a wooden rod or a metal rod, you can tell very quickly its length with a lot of accuracy. You can tell whether there's some sort of bend in the rod and what direction it's being bent in. Individuals can tell what we call the sweet spot of a tennis racket or a baseball bat just by wielding it up and down. And maybe in one of the more impressive examples of this, one experiment involved placing handles, the same type of handle, on a number of different objects of different sizes and shapes. So in one case, the handle was connected to a pyramid shape, in another case, a square, a box shape, or a sphere shape. And there were a few other shapes in that experiment as well. And so subjects were always holding the same type of handle in each case. They weren't touching more than this, I guess, you know, 4-inch long, 1-inch wide dowel. But these different shapes that were connected to the end of them could be determined just by having the subjects pick up this handle and shake the handle back and forth. So the torsions, the pressures that were imparted to the tendons and muscles reflected back to the brain, so the subject could make judgments and say, well, what I'm wielding now is the sphere. What I'm wielding now is the pyramid or the cube. And they could do this with impressive accuracy.
Fascinating. Well, one other thing that we seem to be doing subconsciously that is impressively accurate is smelling our hormonal states. Most people are aware of the concept of pheromones and can point to the phenomenon of women's menstrual cycles syncing up when they are in a dormitory situation as evidence for this. But we've learned a lot about these sort of subliminal perceptions of hormonal states, but it goes far beyond that, doesn't it? Please tell us some of what the research on pheromones and this unconscious smelling that we're doing of something that isn't actually an odor.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is absolutely fascinating. And your listeners might know that the human pheromone story has had some controversy. It's not something that's been universally accepted by the scientific community. But I think there is very compelling evidence that our olfactory systems, our smell systems, are doing a lot of things subliminally, especially when it comes to smelling other people. Most of these experiments involve having people smell T-shirts or being presented smells in some other way. And in almost all these cases, the smells are not consciously detectable. Maybe you have a T-shirt in front of you or something like that, and you don't necessarily know that there's a smell on there. You're not sure if this is one of the smell conditions or not. So some of these experiments are just fascinating. It turns out that the smell of someone that's a sample taken when they are in a scared state, when presented to naive subjects, will actually do things like increase the startle response or the blink response, or make people subtly make judgments on pictures that are more negative and more fearful. So that's one way that it seems that smells are being communicated between people. The other way is what you mentioned, and that has to do with the fact that, especially for women who are not on any birth control, they will find the smell of a man's T-shirt more or less attractive depending on how complementary that person's, what we call MHC, is with their own. MHC is the major histocompatibility complex, and it's part of the genome that seems to code, among for other things, I guess, immune system and autoimmune things. And what you find is that when two people get together and have children that have complementary, when the two people have complementary MHC, their children seem to have healthier immune systems. And so what you find is that women, when they're smelling these T-shirts of strangers, will find the T-shirts more attractive if, in fact, that individual has an MHC that is complementary to their own. If it is less complementary, they'll find that smell less pleasant. And that seems to be the case for a majority of women that are tested in these experiments.
I was also interested in learning that female strippers get better tips during the time of the month when they're ovulating, at least if they're not on the birth control pill. Do you think this is pheromones as well?
Yeah, that's one of the speculations. Now, that exact experiment hasn't been tested for pheromone involvement. But yes, what you find is that individuals, strippers that are ovulating, do get better tips. Now, this does bring up this other issue, which is the idea of hidden estrus. It's been long thought that estrus is hidden in humans for various evolutionary reasons. But I think that the research is showing that even though it might be overtly hidden, it does get communicated in some interesting ways. So men tend to find images of women, pictures of a woman's face, more attractive when she's in estrus than when not. And of course, these male subjects are not told this about the women, that they're in estrus or not. And the same thing's true with smell and sound, for that matter. Let me talk about smell first. Men find a T-shirt worn by a woman in estrus as more attractive than in any other part of the month. And a woman's voice tends to change. Her voice itself tends to change a little bit during estrus, and men tend to find a woman's voice when being recorded in estrus more attractive than in other times of the month as well. So it's as if this is being communicated in very subtle ways in each of the senses, but maybe together it can have enough of an influence that, you know, it bears a little bit on mating behavior.
I'm struck by something that was said to me many years ago by a friend as she was going through menopause. And she said, once you go through menopause, you just disappear as far as men are concerned.
Wow. It's interesting if that bears on it. I really don't know.
No, I don't either. But I just was flashed on that as you were saying that. And I wonder if there might not be a grain of truth to the fact that you're no longer olfactorily as interesting.
It could be. It could have something to do with it. I think smell affects things in that way, that it bears on these sort of things without us having explicit awareness of its bearing. And so I wouldn't be surprised if it was part of the equation.
Well, since the MHC antigens are also what we use to determine organ transplant matches. I'm wondering if we might be able to pre-screen samples by the T-shirt method. What do you think?
Well, I wouldn't want my organs being chosen just on the T-shirt method, but it's neat to know that it's so far-reaching, it really is, and that we have ways of detecting this through our sensory systems and our brains. I think it's fascinating.
It really is. And ultimately, I think what your research and some of the other research that you describe in your very interesting book, See What I'm Saying, is stuff that anyone can apply to their daily life, and it just makes life more interesting to read books like yours. So thank you very much, Lawrence Rosenblum, for writing it.
Oh, thank you very much.
And thanks for being on the show.
My pleasure.
There's a lot more in See What I'm Saying than what we've talked about. It's chock full of interesting facts and anecdotes, and I found it an extremely pleasant read. So I highly recommend it to all of you out there. And again, Dr. Rosenblum, thank you so much.
Thank you.
After engaging with Dr. Rosenblum in that interview, both Charlie and I were very intrigued about this concept of human echolocation. If you search the web, the name of Ben Underwood will surface. Ben is a young man who lost his vision at the age of 3 due to a cancer of the eyes. That cancer unfortunately ended his life at the age of 16. But in the intervening years, Ben learned to navigate using echolocation. You can search YouTube, Echolocation Ben Underwood, and find amazing videos of him navigating a narrow space between parked cars. You can see him walking along a path he has never seen before, and just by his clicks, able to stay on the pavement and avoid the grass. And it makes one think about the properties of sound and how the reflection of sound might help you distinguish something that is tall but narrow at the base and wide at the top would become encoded in your brain as, oh, that's a tree. Or something that was tall and wide all the way up would become encoded in your brain as, that's a fence. As you watch the videos, listen carefully to the sound that Ben makes. It is sharp, clean, with a brief peak, perfect for echolocation. I tried really hard to reproduce his sound and couldn't do it. I think it must take a lot of practice. Ben's passing from his cancer is tragic, and it also brings to my mind, at least, a great sense of optimism about human potential. If you search Wikipedia on echolocation, you will encounter tales of other people who have successfully transcended their blindness to develop this extra sense. And it fills me with a sense of hope for the enormous capacity for reprogramming, for adaptation that is contained in our neural nets, in our software, in our brain. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long, and stay healthy.